Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmetic, and it's great to have you guys here. We're back with another one of our famous double episodes where we keep having these amazing guests on. And what happens is, as always, we end up just talking to them for an extended period of time. We don't want to let them go without telling more of their story. And Sean Maxwell was no different with that. So we're going to be coming up here in just a second with part two of our episode about the Snohomish County, Washington mudslide and the response to that event. But before we get to that, let's go ahead and introduce our esteemed co-host. Sam Bradley is back with us.
Well, hello there. And I think if we were ever close to getting a triple episode, it was probably this one. We didn't want to quit.
Yeah, we could have kept going. And we're going to definitely have Sean back, as you will hear at the end of this episode. We talked with Sean about coming back with several different topics that he still had in the can that he could have talked about. But we have to keep these to a reasonable level of recording here and there. So we will definitely have Sean back. Dr. Joe Holly is with us again. And Dr. Joe, this is really one of the best episodes we've recorded to date.
Yeah, really, really great episode. You know, I think this one demonstrated the sort of ICS principles and those core issues that seem to recur in disasters time after time. And Sean just lived them and just made for a really great podcast.
So without too much further ado, let's go ahead and jump on in with this episode with part two of our discussion with Sean Maxwell. The pieces fit together, Sean. And I don't know if that was your plan or if it was a group plan, but I'm just listening to you describe it and thinking of it as a triage person, as a paramedic, as a nurse, and everything. All the pieces that needed to fit together were put in place, and just an elegant solution to a problem that must have seemed insurmountable at the time.
Yeah, it was like building blocks. So I started to laugh because I come in, you know, each morning at 5, and they go, okay, well, this is what we're adding to your assignments, and this is our new challenge for the day. And it just became part of the daily life. Like I started to kind of joke. I'm like, okay, well, I wonder what my new challenge and my new assignment will be today. If they didn't take away the old assignments, they just added to it because the situation and the response just kept growing rapidly. But just became kind of part of the normal course, and just taking, you know, went to our doctors were great. They would come out and they would ride along with me and walk the debris field with me and gave advice on what should be in our spike medic backpacks. And just took the spike medic idea. I felt like that's what we called them 20 years ago. We'd have medics way up in the woods for our wildfire responses, and it just kind of brought everything together and made up plans and made up systems.
So you took concepts that were already out there and just adapted them to your given situation.
Yeah, and the National Guard were just great. I go, okay, I have this crazy idea that would you build me wooden pathways and respond at a moment's notice to come take people out? And they're like, whatever you need, we will do it. They were just awesome that way. You know, the plans were changing, and I'd ask more for them every day. And every day, really with a smile on their face, they would say, sounds good. We got it. We got it.
Well, and they love to respond. That's what they do. I'm sure they were grateful for the opportunity to help.
Yeah. And the other thing was, you know, keeping our medic units and our spike mechs available, there was obviously tons of blisters and slivers and cuts and wounds and all these primary care issues. And they brought in and either would have a PA and a doctor and then their field medics, and they set up tents on both ends of the debris field. And they would take care. They could, you know, take care of wounds, prescribe antibiotics, and take care of all the primary care issues right there on both edges of the debris field. So that really kept our emergency responders ready to go.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah, Joe, that sounds a lot like the way you talk about how you have to monitor your teams and keep track of what's going on and keep everybody healthy so that they can keep doing their job.
Oh, exactly right. I mean, it's the same processes that we use inside the team that apply that scale up to an event this size that incorporates the military and forestry and local fire department and neighboring fire departments and everybody that comes to help in one of those events. It truly is ICS at its best.
Good point.
So, the other really interesting thing was the medical, the reserve veterinary corps. And I didn't realize, and I'm sure it's a national thing, and there's a state reserve corps for animals, but they came in and we had vet ambulances that they assigned to us that we staged on both ends of the debris field and then a vet station at the top. And because these, at one point, the rescue dogs, they were like avalanche dogs and stuff, and they were, some of them had vomiting and diarrhea, they were hypothermic and dehydrated, and they were trying to search when there's sharp objects pointing out of them, when their noses are trying to search through the mud. And they were wonderful, and they were just troopers. But we had to set up a whole medical system for the animals too. And once again, the National Guard came into play because these dogs would be just freezing cold, covered in mud, and then they would get injured. And so the National Guard also came to my rescue there. They would respond to the dogs with a gator, and they would pick up the dog and the handler, and then they would go down. We had a hazmat decontamination stations with heated water, so we'd take them to the decon stations on either end, decon the dog, and then move them over to the makeshift aid stations for the animal. So we had to have a full vet response. And ICS is great and paramedics are great, but I'd never dealt with setting up an animal EMS system.
But you needed it, and so it was there. And I'm really glad to hear that, being a dog lover like I am.
Yeah, so, and
go ahead, Sean.
Oh yeah, I mean before we had vets in, there were regular doctors that would like start IVs on the dogs and hydrate them. It was interesting. It was freezing out there most of the time, and they're in mud, but yet they're still getting dehydrated because I think these dogs were just working so hard. So it's definitely helpful for the hazmat to have heated water. That was really ended up being more. Everybody who came off the debris field, because we didn't know what was in it, would have to decon before lunch, before leaving the scene. They decon the vehicles. But that warm water, I think, ended up being more important for the animals than the humans.
Well, it's another case of adapt and overcome. I mean, it sounds like you said, you started your day with a challenge, but you always met the challenge, even though it was something different every day. And this was obviously one of them. Because who would have thought about, I mean, the dogs aren't trained to deal with mud and cold and wet like that. It's amazing. Yeah. I'm just amazed.
Yeah, and I've heard you say, Sam and Joe and some of the other people we've had on the show in the past have all said that the dogs will work themselves to the bone if you let them. And you almost have to watch them more carefully than you do your team members.
I heard that repeated so many times, Jamie, over the course of the incident. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing were animal remains. That was another thing that was assigned to us is, a lot of people lost their pets, and supposedly this had gone to a ranch and stuff too. So not only did they have a reunification system set up for the human loved ones, many people were, obviously this was interested in being reunified with their animal loved ones. So we used different, and it was hard because we were out in such a remote area to get like the Humane Society and different agencies like that up there on a regular basis, because you didn't know when you were going to find stuff. So we actually use different colored body bags for humans and animals, because that would be catastrophic to have anything mixed up like that. So we use different colored body bags to make sure we got that right. And then we worked out a staging system for the animals to get them into Animal Control or the Humane Society, who would check for chips. And then we set up a website so people could look on the web to find their animals.
Oh, good idea. So Sean, are you now setting up a course of training on this kind of mudslide response? Should it happen to anybody else in the future, taking all your lessons learned?
You know, the only place I've presented this is at the GEMS conference. I haven't been asked to, and you guys are really the first people to follow up on this since the year since it happened.
Well, we've been trying to. We should have gotten a hold of you sooner. This is amazing.
This is amazing, and you know, Joe, it leads me back, you know, to all the things. I mean, I'm not the disaster responder that you guys are. I'm a local EMS responder, but not specifically trained for disaster response. And so I'm learning through this show over the last year or so, and hearing Sean talk brings back all of the things, Joe, that you continually say about preparedness and doing the right kind of training and that stress immersion so that you can make good decisions and improvise on the fly when you need to. And it seems like these lessons are just being reinforced by everything Sean's talked about today.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. You know, it's funny that the commonalities of all types of disasters of any sort just continue to bring out the same lessons time after time. And, you know, as we've said a lot of times before, I think a lot of that is that so many folks don't get an opportunity to ever do that at all, or certainly not much more than once. So it's that opportunity to train as you roll into that to make you better able to handle it as the case may be. So
I don't know, maybe Paragon needs to have a mudslide drill now. You never know.
Well, you know, I think the nice thing is it's almost the disaster du jour. You know, in many cases, it doesn't really matter what the underlying event is. The principles are all the same, and the techniques and processes that go in place, including cool things like checklists, are really part of what get things done. You know, I just got several of my friends off last week to go to Nepal for that monster earthquake over there. And, you know, part of what we were doing is running through our final checklist to get those guys out the door and keep them safe over there.
Well, and Nepal's a perfect example of how one event can cause multiple different outcomes given the terrain and the different areas. I mean, you had an earthquake, so you have building collapse and things like that in urban settings. There were mudslides and landslides all in the outlying areas because of the mountainous terrain. You had avalanches occurring in the snow-covered regions around Everest. All of these needed a different type of response level to them, given the different challenges that each presents. And that's probably why that country has been so devastated by this, because they're not a very populous country, not a very wealthy country, and the bringing resources to bear. I understand that their airport in Nepal is so small, they can only land a few planes at a time, and then they have to take them off to make room for new planes. So it's a huge challenge, and it's an example of how we need to just look at all of these lessons from what Sean's learned from what happened with this mudslide to challenges with earthquakes, to challenges with avalanches, to challenges with floods. Like you said in the beginning, Sean, when we first started this episode, there was a real concern for a while about a major flood event.
Yeah. We didn't know if there would be a catastrophic breakthrough or if it would just slowly work its way through, and it slowly worked its way through and just opened up slowly, which was good. That was another thing I'd never seen before in my life, is they had, for part of the search, they brought in full-size excavators that floated on pontoons that were digging through the flooded area. Upstream all flooded. So we were searching through these lakes, basically these instant lakes. And now I know that you could call for a floating excavator.
Wow.
Good point.
You don't know what you need till you need it, right, Sean?
Exactly.
And somebody will figure it out. Somebody will figure it out.
Yeah, and I mean, you just don't picture those things floating in the river.
Well, there wasn't a river there until there was, but it wasn't that big, right? I mean, this is the challenge that you face, and I think that you guys have given a really good example of preparing for the worst, and then even though you're overwhelmed by what you thought the worst could be, you still apply the lessons learned, still get those things done. And it reminds me of all the things, Joe, that you guys talk about at Paragon. And so we just want to thank you, Sean, for coming on today and talking about this. One quick plug for you. What's going on with your checklists? I know you said the 2015 checklists are in the process of getting printed right now. Tell everybody a little bit about how this checklist system came about.
Yeah, do you want me to touch on our? We did have our community paramedics respond up to the disasters. You want me to touch on that? Or
absolutely, yeah. I didn't even know that your system was in place at that point.
Yeah, well, it started on January 1st, and in March the slide happened, and I was up there running it, and it was interesting on how you partner with your public health. We had partnered with our public health a long time ago during the H1N1 and vaccinating all the emergency responders in our county. So we learned how to do an emergency declaration with our public health officer to allow paramedics to do vaccination. So we took that relationship and that lesson learned and pulled our community paramedic up to the debris field, and he basically helped prop up public health. He went through and did like epi surveillance and said, you know, we need more wash stations before, you know, we have any kind of GI illnesses break out, because there are signs that they could break out soon. But the dogs were obviously having vomiting and diarrhea, and we didn't know if septic systems had been blown up and spread through this, or what chemicals we were dealing with throughout the debris field, which everyone was digging in, you know, all day long. So he helped with surveillance. And then we put vaccines like the tetanus vaccine in the back of his Tahoe, and he was a mobile vaccination unit driving across the scene, offering vaccines to the 900 responders. And I mean, not only did we had volunteer shifts going out there, but we also had, you know, National Guard that was saying, you know, I want my tetanus re-up. I'm nervous about that. So it was a unique way to deploy the community paramedic. And I would, I think it's a definitely an area to explore. I know Alberta, during their big floods, they had deployed their community paramedic.
I hadn't really thought about the using a community paramedic in this type of system, but you know, Joe, that's an interesting application of what many people consider a primary care resource. But you do need those kind of primary care resources in these major events.
Absolutely, I was thinking exactly the same thing. That in many cases, a community paramedic may be really an ideal candidate to deploy into situations like that. He'll have the understanding of sort of the EMS side of things and the field work side of things, but can bring a whole different perspective on everything from epidemiology and community health to sort of long-term illnesses, especially, we've talked before about how much trouble folks with chronic illness have in these disaster situations because of the loss of infrastructure. And a guy like that would be truly perfectly fit to make a huge contribution in those situations.
And they're paramedics, so they're used to that kind of environment. They're used to being out there. You know, they're not like hospital types that never get out of the building. So well, they're perfect.
They've got the incident command background. They've got all that. They're used to working in that type of unified team, at least supposedly, depending on where they were educated and everything else. But it's interesting, Sean, that you guys applied that. And again, just points to how you pulled many disparate resources together to achieve a common goal.
Yeah. Yeah, the community paramedic, I needed something. I knew we had that. And it was, like you said, for all the reasons you said, their turnkey. I didn't have to train them or prep them. All I said is, can you show up tomorrow morning? I need this. And he was off and running.
Yeah, that's a subject for a whole podcast I think we ought to do sometime. It's a great idea.
The partnership with public health is huge, too, because public health, I think they're one of the forgotten emergency response agencies, and I had noticed we were able to bring them up in our vehicles and show them the landscape, show them the things we were concerned about, and you could see they're concerned to go into different areas, and we're like, no, just stand by my side, we'll take you through, we need your expert eyes on this that we don't have, but they need our expertise in keeping them safe and following into the command system, so it was just a great partnership.
Well, I hope we can get you back, Sean. There's so much more to talk about. And this was one of the better podcasts we've ever done, I think.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, yeah, we didn't even talk about the wildfires.
We'll have you back another time, maybe in a month or so. We'll have you back talk about the wildfires.
I think we tie that one back together again with him later on. That'd be great.
We're not done with you, Sean.
Oh, man.
You got too much good information for us. And I'm just amazed that we're one of the few to actually want to talk about these mudslides. That amazes me. You've learned so many important things from this.
This has been a different kind of show. I mean, we've talked about well-known disasters many times on this event, on this podcast. We've talked about the Haiti earthquake, and we've had how many people that have responded to the Haiti earthquake? 4 or 5 guests on. We've had numerous Katrina responders on. We've talked about Ground Zero, both in New York and then also 9/11 at the Pentagon. It amazes me, given what I've learned today about this event, that this event hasn't fallen in the same category as these other events, just if only for the lessons learned and the way the system worked.
You know, Jamie, I think that's probably only true on the public visibility level. I know, you know, inside the USAR world, we spent an awful lot of time looking at this deployment and the lessons learned from it. So, I think it's just been not publicized as well as some of the others.
Well, I hope so, because I think that, you know, Sean, you guys need to know that you did good. And we can certainly say that here on this podcast, and our audience will certainly hear us say it. But from myself and alone, if no one else, and I know the rest of the team here feels the same way.
Absolutely.
You guys, pulled a heck of a job out of what you had basically nothing to start with.
You rocked the mudslide. Seriously, good job. And more people need to know what you learned from that. This is not something that should be a secret.
Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, it was amazing people, amazing collaboration for a pretty, pretty tough event.
Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap this episode up, but Sean, we'd like to reserve the right to have you back on in the future and talk about some other things.
Sure, I'd be happy to. This was really enjoyable speaking with all of you.
Where can folks, if we want to get in touch with you, if they left a comment on the site, would you be willing to come back and respond back to any questions people have or comments?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely do that over at disasterpodcast.com. And when they come in, we'll shoot you an email so that you can shoot a response back. We get comments and questions from our audience from time to time, and we like to get them. And I have a feeling this episode is going to be one that spurs those kinds of comments. Joe, you know, we've talked a little bit about Paragon and the type of education you do. This is exactly the kind of event that you hope to prepare your students for when you come into a system.
Oh, you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, again, it's the commonalities of those core lessons and processes are so important. And I think Sean, you know, by adapting that ICS strategy and doing the incredible work that he did, just goes to prove that it is those processes that make a difference.
So where can folks find Paragon if they want to find out about what they can do to bring you into their system or a combination of systems? I know you were just in Florida and did something like 600 and some odd students run through your system.
I'll give a quick shout out to Castleberry, Florida. They did a great job hosting us, and we really enjoyed it for an incredible number of students in just 4 days. So quite an activity down there. Folks can find Paragon on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And you can always leave a message for us on the Disaster Podcast website.
Excellent. Sam, how about you? Where can folks find you?
Well, in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. And seriously, we do hope that you not only listen to this, but you have some thoughts and comments for Sean. I mean, I'm just blown away by this whole discussion. And I think we touched new ground here, Jamie, don't you think?
Absolutely. This is, I don't know if it was because I didn't know as much about this response that it's made such an impact on me, but if it was just the magnitude that they pulled together and got a system in place on such short notice, and then were able to keep it in place for such an extended period of time. But something about this is definitely different than anything else we've really talked about.
Very definitely.
Yep. So, you know, folks, you can find me under the handle PodMedic just about everywhere on social media. And you can find my shows, various programs that I do over at MedicCast.com. But, of course, for this, we want you to head over to DisasterPodcast.com and leave a comment over there. It automatically emails us and lets us know you've left a comment. We'll come back and respond, in you know, within the next day or so. If you want to leave a message there for Sean, even if it's just, you know, kudos to what you guys did, you can do that. Just leave that comment there, and we'll let Sean know to come back and look at that and leave a comment back for you. But we want to make sure that you are involved with this show. Did you like hearing what Sean had to say? Do you want to hear more of that kind of program? You need to let us know, or we'll just keep making it up as we go along. We love what we do, but we want to make sure that you're getting something out of it too. So make sure you head over to disasterpodcast.com. And you know, Sam, I think this more than anything else we've touched on just leads us to learn a little bit more about the trials and tribulations of disaster medicine.
I was thinking exactly the same thing, Jamie, and it makes me wonder what else is out there that we haven't seen yet. It's almost kind of scary, but it certainly goes to prove that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.